Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. You can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/lostheplotcast. I highly recommend Amanda Palmer's book, The Art of Asking, and you can get it for free. Just visit audibletrial.com/lostheplotcast. All right, let's do this. From Milieu Media Group, this is Ryan Hamilton's Lost the Plotcast. I'm your host, Ryan Hamilton, and this is Episode 3, Riding the Wave with Kay Hanley. Hello, and welcome to Episode 3. First of all, I want to say thank you again for making this podcast a hit. It's crazy. It keeps sneaking up into the top 10 on iTunes. And it's exciting. It feels really good. I'm really happy people are loving it. You know how this sort of thing goes. You want it to be fun and you hope it's good and well received. So for it to be going the way it's going, especially this early in the process, it means a bunch. So thanks a lot. I want to talk about our guest today and then talk a little bit about this crazy business of music. The conversation that I'm going to share in today's episode is with Kay Hanley. Most of you will know her from Letters to Cleo, even though she's done so many great things, not just on her own musically, but, you know, things like Doc McStuffins or the soundtrack for Josie and the Pussycats, things like 10 Things I Hate About You, or if you're familiar with the television show Parks and Recreation, you'll know how it kind of relates to Kay's story. And full disclosure, Kay is a friend, so I just called her up on the phone. We had a great chat. I actually think people are going to love this one a little bit extra. People don't realize how much the music business changed after things like cell phones and, of course, the big bad internet. Kay provides a fascinating insight into that pre-cell phone, pre-internet 90s music world. Letters to Cleo were a huge deal from about 1993 until the early 2000s, really. So they had the bulk of their success pre-cell phone and pre-internet for the most part, you know? And that's crazy. I mean, I think it was probably, arguably, more exciting back then. Because, and like you'll hear Kay say, it took a while for big news to reach you, you know, and things were more of a surprise. And then, you know, also things like not knowing if anyone was going to show up at your shows, you know, it's not like people could go look at a Facebook page. Facebook didn't exist. You couldn't go to a Facebook page to see how many, I'm doing finger quotes, how many likes you have or a band has, or, you know, how many people have RSVP'd to your Facebook event. And then, you know, other things like printing out actual flyers at a Kinko's or having to use a real map. You know what I mean? Like, people don't think about this. Can you imagine you're on tour, whether you're on a bus and you have a driver or you're in a van, which a lot of bands were back in the day, and you have a map. You have an actual map. You have to look at a map and figure out where to go, how to get to where, you know, it's actually sort of sad to me that blows my mind, people using an actual map instead of their phone. Just, it's silly, really. Kay provides a wonderful snapshot of the, you know, the not too long ago 90s. It wasn't that long ago, and it really is like a different world. In the music business particularly, this is also the musical world that I came up going to concerts in the 90s. So I'm very partial to that era of music, as everyone is when it comes to the music that, you know, they first fell in love with. Even though, admittedly, I first fell in love with the Beatles and what people would consider classic rock because that's what I would listen to as a kid with my dad. But the first concerts I was going to, you know, were when Kay and Letters to Cleo were at the height of their success, even though they've reformed and they're still killing it. But yeah, I was going to concerts in the 90s. I was going to see bands like the Toadies or Tripping Daisy. Those are Texas bands that, you know, went on to do great things. Anyway, I'm going to shut up. I want to share this conversation. I really do think it's fascinating to hear her talk about how it was then and some of the super cool stuff that happened for her and for their band. And not just Letters to Cleo, getting into the TV world and doing Doc McStuffins and things like that. I'm going to let her tell you. I really think you guys are going to enjoy this. Here's my chat with my friend, Kay Hanley. I just think, I know people are fascinated by that and how the music business went, what the fuck do we do now?
Yeah, and how do you make the move from A, lead singer in a rock band in the old world to working musician, making money in the new world of digital platforms and, you know, the whole digital marketplaces?
Yeah.
Has changed the game.
Right? I want to start with Letters to Cleo and just talk about the big success you guys had in the 90s before the old business model kind of went to shit. And can you just tell me a little bit, like, what it was like to have success in the music business pre-internet?
I mean, it's funny to think that the entire time that I was on the road touring in my rock band, the first 10 years of my touring life, we didn't even have cell phones.
Yeah.
So we would have to pull the van over to advance the show at a payphone. You know, there was no email. We were on Beavis and Butthead. Letters to Cleo was on Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah.
We didn't even find out until 24 hours later. I mean,
that's
like, can you imagine? Because, like, we were on the bus, like, between Texas and Nebraska, you know, so it's like, we didn't know. And
did you guys?
So we showed up at soundcheck the next day, and then there were kids waiting outside, and they were like, holy shit, you were on Beavis and Butthead last night. We were like, what? You know? So from that standpoint, it was, you know, of course, we had no crystal ball. We didn't know how much easier things could be, but then again, how much harder things could be.
Mm.
When you're constantly being fed instant gratification, I think it kind of eats away at your drive, and it also eats away at, like, your mystery. You know, I hate knowing every single fucking thing that's in the head of people I admire.
Yeah.
It makes me admire them less.
Yeah.
But as for, you know, having success, I mean, we'd been on the road for years and years and years and in our van and had our day jobs and just kind of took our van out of Boston and went around the country whenever we could. But our overnight success was on a TV soundtrack, which at the time was so, like, that was not indie cred, dude. And, like, you just didn't fucking do that.
Yeah.
Like, and so we were on the Melrose Place soundtrack, and
that's,
we made a video
right.
for a song that ended up playing at the end of Melrose Place. And I had to talk about that thing for, like, the rest of our careers. Like, I still have to, from time to time, talk about Melrose Place, like I am right now.
Yeah.
Even though you didn't ask, I'm just offering it.
You just can't help it.
Right. It's just a habit.
Heather Locklear on that show, she did something to me as a young man. My goodness.
Really?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That show was a huge deal. It was one of the first shows where, like, my parents watched it and I watched it, kind of a thing.
Right, right, yeah.
So it had to be just, even though maybe you didn't get the indie cred, it had to be the coolest thing ever to be on that show, like, at the time.
It was kind of terrifying.
Was it?
It really did feel like, even after, you know, many years in our band and playing so many shows, we were already, like, working. We were already pretty much done writing our second album when that song from our first album hit.
Wow.
And it was like something weird happened overnight.
Yeah.
You know, I remember getting to South by Southwest that year and, like, going to the laundromat or something. And I had my hair in ponytails. That was how I wore my hair. And someone's like, oh my God, you look like the girl from Letters to Cleo in that video. And I was like, what? It was really kind of scary to me. I can't say that I liked it. It didn't feel exciting or great. It felt scary to me.
Like intrusive? It felt intrusive?
Yeah. And I remember I didn't wear my hair in ponytails after that.
Wow. It's so crazy you know, how many photos do we all put of ourselves on the internet now so everybody knows what everybody looks like? Just how much things have changed. It's so black and white, totally different. I want to talk about Letters to Cleo getting signed. So you guys got signed to Giant Records, right? Which was part of Warner Brothers?
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little about how the band got signed?
Yeah. So this was South by Southwest the year before.
Okay.
We played South by Southwest. Like, the first 2 years that we played, our show was canceled. So we got there in our van, and our shows were canceled. It was
That's terrible. Yeah.
And then the third year we went, which was 1993, we had just put out our Aurora Borealis on a local record, Boston label called Cherry Disc. And the week of our showcase at South by Southwest, this one was at the Electric Lounge, so it was happening. So Billboard magazine had a review of Aurora Borealis that ran on the front page, and it was like this glowing review, and it was incredible. So our manager and our booking agent ran down to Kinko's, made copies of the billboard with our review on the cover, and went down to the Four Seasons, which is where all the A&R people hung out when they weren't at shows, and just handed out copies of the cover of Billboard with our review on it. And our showcase was packed, and we got taken out to our first free breakfast by a record label the next morning, and that was Bennett Kaufman from RCA Records.
Wow.
And I remember this because it was such a huge event in my life. Like, I'd heard about this stuff happening to other people,
right?
And I never thought it would happen to us, you know. So, and I'm still actually friends with Bennett Kaufman to this day.
But, That's cool.
But we ended up going with Jeff Aldridge from Giant Records, which was Irving Aboff's label in Los Angeles. He flew out to Boston and took us out to a bunch of the Four Seasons in Boston. So, you know, by then, we had been wined and dined by all the labels. It was so awesome. And he was like, you know, everybody said the same thing, like, you know, I'm going to make you a star and all that stuff.
Right.
But what Jeff Aldridge brought to the table was he was putting out this record, the soundtrack for Melrose Place, and Paul Westerberg was going to be on it, and Amy Mann, and Dinosaur Jr., and, like, all these people were going to be on the soundtrack. And we were like, oh, my God, we have to, can we be on this record?
Right.
Not knowing what this was going to mean. And he was like, just sign on the dotted line, and you're on the record. And we were like, done. And so that was really the selling point. And we re-recorded Here and Now and Rimshack for the Giant Records release of Aurora Borealis. And they put it out like a couple months later, and by the fall, it was on the radio. So I thought at the time, like, oh, that's how it works. Like, you sign to a label, and they put out your single, and it gets on the radio, and then it goes to the top 10, and then you put out And so I just thought it would just be like any other job. Like, you just work your way up. And, of course, that's not
easy.
How it works.
It's easy.
At all. Right. It doesn't work that way at all.
Well, I think things like that clearly don't happen that way anymore. I love just the idea of going to Kinko's and making actual copies and printing them out and flyering. Like, now people are spamming everyone with emails. I had a guy tell me recently, a radio promo guy, he said that he's reverted back to sending physical copies of CDs because it's a unique and cool thing to do now. Because everyone else...
That's so funny.
I know. It's like the old school way they've reverted back, because people get so many emails now.
Right.
To get an actual CD is like, oh, wow.
To get like a package in the mail.
I know.
So unusual.
I know. So I think stories like that, not only am I personally fascinated with that sort of thing, because I'm a huge music nerd, people don't know, they don't realize how drastically things have changed.
Right.
I should ask this. Did you guys sign a good deal? Like, did you have a good relationship with the label, or did you fall victim to a bad deal like a lot of bands did then?
I'm glad you asked that. We were a pretty rare story in that we had the same A&R guy, the guy that took us out to lunch that day at the Four Seasons in Boston, Jeff Aldrich.
Yeah.
He was our A&R guy. We signed a 3-record firm deal with the label, and we made 3 records with them.
That's
and
great.
All of them were helmed by the same A&R guy. And I felt, up until the last record, things got weird. Like, they had a shakeup at the label. So, like, a new GM came in, whose name I won't mention, because I have nothing nice to say. but before that, the GM of the label was this guy named Steve Backer, who was just, like, actually, who just died recently, which is horrible.
Yeah.
But he was, like, a huge, like, we felt really taken care of and really cared about at the label. And even on our second record, when, you know, when Awake, which I think is one of the best songs we ever put out, but, you know, it didn't hit. It didn't, you know, it cracked the top 40 on the alternative charts, but really not much more than that. But the label loved the songs, and they, you know, we went out on the road, and we still had our audience, and, you know, we were road dogs, so that was another thing that was good. We also had a manager from Boston who was like, when, you know, when the record didn't hit, he was just like, all right, I'm just going to book a million college dates in the fall and September to pay the bills.
And
so we didn't feel it as dramatically as a band may have that had all their hopes and dreams riding on what the label did or didn't do. We weren't really as vulnerable to that as maybe other bands were, because we were already road dogs, and that's kind of just what we did, so we didn't feel it as much.
Right on. I think people most that will listen to this won't realize how rare it is to have the same A&R person for 3 albums.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, because once your A&R person goes, you're probably screwed.
Yeah.
There's so many different layers to a record deal and the business that goes into it after the fact, and we don't have to go all the way down that rabbit hole because we'll be talking for hours. But I think that it's incredible how rare it is to have the same A&R guy for 3 albums. So,
yeah.
Lucky
we were
you guys.
Really lucky.
Yeah. So, Letters to Cleo, you were signed in what, like 93?
The Cherry Disc record came out in 93. So we put out the giant release in 94.
Okay. And then the band called it quits, even though you guys got back together recently and have had some new music and some more tour dates. When was the initial, okay, we're calling it a day for now? What, do you know what year?
That was 2000.
Okay. So you guys had, like, a solid decade of really going for it.
Yeah, we did.
And then the band calls it quits, but you still have some cool stuff happening, like, after the 3rd album, or around, I guess, like the Josie and the Pussycat soundtrack, the 10 Things I Hate About You. So that stuff is happening. Is the band at that time going, okay, this cool stuff is happening, but we're actually done? Or was it kind of, all of this happened, now we're done?
We started recording the 10 Things I Hate About You stuff in, like, 1997. So that was around the time that Go came out. That was our last record.
Uh-huh.
So all of that was kind of happening at the same time.
Okay.
But we had already done, like, the crap. We were kind of into doing soundtracks at the time. We did, and a lot of our peers were doing that, too.
Yeah.
So that was just kind of part and parcel of, like, being in a band at that time. There was a guy named Ralph Saul, who was a producer at Fox, who ended up falling into this really cool niche of putting together soundtracks for movies featuring covers by popular rock bands at the time. So we were definitely on his Rolodex, and he would always call us in to do. So for 10 Things I Hate About You, I think we spent, like, we just flew in for the weekend to do a bunch of covers for the soundtrack and just see which ones they wanted. And while we were there, the director called Ralph and was like, I need a rock band for a couple of scenes for the movie. And Ralph was like, well, Letters to Cleo's right here. Do you want them to come?
He's
like,
great.
Send me a picture. So he sent him a picture. And the next thing you know, we're flying up to Seattle to film 10 Things I Hate About You.
So cool.
So that was that was really fun. But at the same time, you know, things were definitely, the cracks were starting to show in our, I don't know, like our crew had always been like such a tight-knit crew. Stacey had left the band, and Tom was awesome and contributed so much. But like when we hit the road for the Go tour after we did the 10 Things I Hate About You thing, things were definitely starting to be like, not as fun.
Right.
At least I'll speak for myself. Like, I definitely, you know, and I was partying a lot. And then we came home, Michael Eisenstein, the guitar player, and I got married. And then we were still on the road, but then I got pregnant in 1999. And at that point, I was just like, no, once we had the baby in June of 99, it was impossible
to like
keep my eyes on the prize. And so it was also around then, when Zoe Mabel was 11 months old, that I got the call for Josie and the Pussycats.
Wow.
So we like packed up our stuff and like went to LA to do Josie and the Pussycats. And it was right around then that I called Greg and I was just like, I don't want to do Cleo anymore. I can't.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do another record.
Do you think?
And that was the beginning of my whole new life.
Right. Well, that's a good segue into this question. So starting this new chapter of your life, you know, you're going to be a mom. You are a mom. Do you ever look back on that and go, man, we actually timed that really well? Because right around then, you know, Napster was here, iTunes had started, the record stores were closing. Do you feel like you guys got out just in time, or did you feel some of that whenever it happened?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the trajectory of my career has been, in retrospect, even though not all of it has been like awesome all the time. Like, I've definitely gotten dinged in this business for sure.
Yeah.
But in terms of riding the wave, I feel like I've had a dream career.
Right.
Not just because of, you know, the digital revolution. In some ways, I feel like it's made things a lot easier. And I'm not just talking about, you know, streaming platforms and how music is consumed, but I'm also talking about, like, Pro Tools and, like, the ease with which people can make music now. And, I mean, my kind of mantra has always been, the good news is that anyone can make a record, and the bad news is that anyone can make a record.
I know.
And
I have those moments, for sure.
And, you know, I'm glad in a way. I mean, I think my career would have been great, because I do all the stuff. Like, my career has always been about, when I was in a band, it was always about being on the road and, like, selling merch. And I never looked to the label or to radio to provide me with an income. It was always about, so the way I do things would have been really well suited to the way things are now.
Yeah.
And maybe even better if we had been able to utilize the internet to harness. I mean, I remember there was this, like, message board out of Cambridge, like, out of Harvard, like, all that, like, the early, early internet days.
Yeah.
There were, like, all these people who were on this, like, on these chat rooms, like, in 1993 and 94, sort of, like, in the academic world, and they started talking about Letters to Cleo, and we were getting all these people from these chat rooms at our shows around the country back then. So, like, I saw the impact of people being able to communicate in this way, even back then.
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure what the question was or if I even answered it, but...
You did. It was wonderful.
Here we are.
No, it was wonderful. I won't take up too much more of your time, but I want to get from the first kind of, quote, official end of Letters to Cleo to Doc McStuffins. So clearly, you know, there are a few years in between Letters to Cleo calling it a day initially, and then, you know, Doc McStuffins happening, which I think is wonderful.
Thank you.
Of course.
Me too.
The years in between, did you have a plan? Like, was it a struggle, or was it just like, did you just kind of sit back and enjoy being a mom? What was that like to navigate between the end of Letters to Cleo? I know you did some solo stuff, of course.
Yeah.
But then to get to Doc McStuffins. Like, I know that's kind of a big gap.
Well, we moved to L.A. Uh-huh. Actually, I would say that when I was doing Josie and the Pussycats, and I was working with Babyface a lot out here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was still living in Boston and working out here in L.A. And it wasn't so much like, you know, obviously Babyface is filthy rich and has like a million studios and mansions, and I worked with them all.
Right, cool.
And it wasn't his wealth that resonated with me. It was the fact that he was calling the shots, that he was like leading a completely creative life, but it was a business.
Mm.
And something clicked for me at that point that I was like, I can do that. And I never knew that I never made that connection before, that I could be in charge.
Yeah.
Like, I could provide a service and get paid for it.
Yeah.
And that became kind of my holy grail, if you will.
Yeah.
Michael was on the road, and I was home with babies and got pregnant with Henry. And so I was the mother of a toddler, pregnant with a husband who was out on the road touring to support the family. And I was just like, I didn't sign up for this. So he came back from tour, and he was just like, we're moving to L.A. And I was like, make it happen, and I'll go. And it was just like, it was kind of like a seconds and inches kind of thing. If he had got me just like a few hours later in the day, I would have been like, fuck no. But and we went. And I knew that what I wanted to do out here was write music for other people and for TV and film. And I set about doing that. And at some point, pretty quickly after I moved to LA, I met Michelle Lewis, and she and I instantly connected on an intellectual level, on a creative level, on a political level, on a friendship level. We just got it.
That's great.
You know how you meet people like that in your life where you're just like, you just know.
I do, yeah.
That they're your people.
Yep.
Right?
It's almost uncomfortable because you're getting into kind of high school first love type feelings, but it's a friendship.
Yeah.
So you get really excited. Yeah, I love that.
So yeah, so that's what happened. And we started doing what we called our cockamamie scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the cockamamie schemes that we came up with was creating television shows.
Mm-hmm.
And so we created a couple of TV shows, like kids shows, and sold them to Disney.
It's great.
And we did that twice. And neither one of them, you know, got out of development and into production. Yeah. But what we accomplished in that was they knew we had a relationship, and we developed relationships over there, and people, like, really cared about us. And also we became known as people who could really write music for this kind of content. So when the music was in trouble during the pilot process of Doc McStuffins, our people over at Disney were like, we have just the ladies for you. So they called me and Michelle, and we came in originally as consultants, which allowed us to really just like swoop in and take the jobs for ourselves.
Yeah.
So that's what we did, and I've just been kind of developing, Michelle and I have been developing that side of our cockamamie scheme lane together ever since. And so that's what I do.
I think it's so cool that you've gone from, you know, in the van, making flyers at Kinko's, things like that, to what I'm assuming is now a very digital email-based business model, right? So the Doc McStuffins, you know, and what's happening now, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you're, you know, handwriting letters to people and putting them in the mail. I think it's, you know, it's got to be making it happen via email and cell phone and all of the things that didn't exist in 1990.
Oh, yeah, it's totally different. But luckily for me, I guess, I've been kind of, like everything else in my life, just like riding the wave. Like never at any point did I have to like switch gears entirely.
Yeah.
You know, but now obviously everything I do is digital. You know, right now I'm approving mixes that are waiting on my laptop, and then I will, you know, once I approve them, I will put together a package of an MP3 with a lyric sheet, and I'll send out my deliverables to an email list, you know?
Isn't it funny?
So that's everything, so funny. My whole life is in the box. It's crazy, but it didn't ever happen all at once.
Right. Well, you clearly have the drive, you know, and the passion for music and business. So
do I though?
Well, I think.
Do I, Ryan? I think I've just stumbled ass over tea kettle into pretty much everything.
Well, maybe
I don't think I'm any more driven than anybody else. I think I've had some great opportunities, and I've been able to capitalize on them.
There you go. That's the way to say it. Maybe the light bulb moment of working with Babyface just kind of gave you the insight to go, I can do that. And then when the opportunity presented itself, you took advantage in a good way.
Exactly.
All right, let's bring it full circle, and then I'll let you get back to your very busy life. So, Letters to Cleo, call it a day. This time goes by, you know, you're getting to do lots of other fun stuff. And then in the wake of the internet and the television show Parks and Recreation, and I'm sure you've been asked about this a million times, but what I want to talk about is what it was like for you to see all the tweets and to see it kind of be a trending topic. First of all, did you know beforehand, or was it just like the Beavis and Butthead thing back in the day?
Well, I didn't know that that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Mike Schur, who's the showrunner for Parks and Rec, he's a Boston guy, so he's a Cleo fan. And he, I mean, I met him, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like that. And so I knew that they were looking for a particular t-shirt style, which we actually didn't have. It was a t-shirt with the cover of Aurora Borealis on it, our first record. And so I just heard that they were looking for that. Again, we've had the same manager for 25 years, so it's very easy to find us.
Yeah.
but no, I did not know that that was happening, that Adam Scott was going to be wearing a Letters to Cleo shirt in the show until it was trending on Twitter. And then it was just like, what? It was wild.
Well, I think it's great, and I don't know if that was the catalyst or if that was just another kind of, you know, drop in the hat for, you know what, we should get the band back together. But it's really cool just as, and I know you and I are friends, but I'm also a fan. It's cool to see the band, you know, now and whatever you guys decide to do in the future. You're still playing, you know, sold out shows, and you're doing and you're doing it now in the age of, you know, trending topics, which didn't exist.
Well, it's funny because a lot of people that came to these last bunch of shows, and we may have even done this, Michael and I split up in 2010, so it was like, you know, it would keep coming up because of the internet, like, are you guys going to release something new? But Michael and I kind of had to, like, figure out how to, like, parents together, not in a couple, before we could, like, tackle this other stuff. So even, like, after the Parks and Rec thing, like, Michael and I definitely weren't ready to, like, be in a band and be writing songs together again.
Right.
But last year, we were just like, you know, we had kind of just, like, figured out all of our shit, and we were like, all right, the last frontier, writing music together. So that was an amazing process, just writing a couple of songs and putting them out on an EP and hitting the road. And what we discovered was that there were so many kids who, like, grew up on 10 Things I Hate About You and Josie and the Pussycats and discovered our music through those movies and soundtracks, who never got to see us play and never thought that they would ever get to see us play.
Mm-hmm.
So we ran into, it was so emotional and incredible for me to see, meet all of these people who, for whom our music had become so meaningful in the 20 years that we've been gone. I was blown away. It really was just...
How cool.
It was so cool.
Yeah. Isn't she just the best? I mean, she is the best.
And what a cool, I keep saying it, but what a cool insight into not just the music world of the 90s, but just kind of, like she said, of riding the wave and, you know, putting the work in, but just kind of maneuvering with what comes your way, you know? I do want to say this. I think we take so much for granted in today's music world. Actually, you know, just in the world in general, the technology is and the changes. It's pretty incredible if you really think about it. Sometimes I guess I romanticize about the good old days. But the truth is, I'm super thankful for the technology that we have. And I try my best to use it in the smartest way possible to further my musical career, the career of our band. And I just gotta say one more time, I love Kay. Beautiful woman, beautiful voice, and just one of those people who has the magical ability to make those around her smile. Letters to Cleo might be a rare example of an overall positive experience in this business and with a record label, but I think Kay is a great example of staying positive, putting the work in, and seeing the results, you know, just of a quality product, for lack of a cooler word. A product, it's what it is, I guess. And doing it in a non-obsessive, kind of overworked way, which is an easy thing to kind of fall into in today's world. I wish I was more like that, more like Kay, in the sense that I could just, like she said, ride the wave, you know? I do want to make sure I mention this. Kay has a really cool new podcast with a comedian friend of hers. The podcast is called Rock Out With Your Doc Out, which is maybe the greatest podcast title of all time. But they do this really cool thing where they watch and then review and recommend, or don't recommend, documentaries, music documentaries. I'm a huge nerd about that sort of thing. So I, of course, emailed Kay about 4,000 titles and recommendations. But no joke, it's a great podcast. Just like in this business of music, I think it's important to support each other and share, especially when things are good. And it's just a cool new show. So please go check that out. Rock Out With Your Doc Out. All right, guys, please share, rate, review. Let's see if we can get this podcast back up in the top 10. So far, we got a great track record. The first two episodes, every time a new episode is released, it shoots back up to like spot 10 or 9 or 12 or whatever. So let's do it again. I freaking love you, all of you, and see you next Tuesday. This episode was produced, edited, and mixed by Luke Bronner. The artwork we used for this podcast was done by Heather Hale. Please visit halehouse.co for more of her stuff. The theme music you hear is from my band's latest album, The Devil's in the Detail. Please visit Ryan Hamilton and thetraitors.com for more.